Hi there, this is Paul, and you're listening to another edition of Touchstones. This is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. That's 103.5 on your FM dial, and this is your community radio station. We're also available through web streaming at communityradio.coop. That's COOP. So I hope some of us are tuned in from around the country. Today we have our friend Bob Trowbridge, right? Trowbridge?
Close enough. That's it.
Trowbridge.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and no, he's not a troll. So we're going to be discussing spiritual direction. Bob is putting on a workshop on October 11th here in Chapel Hill. Where's it going to be?
It's in Chapel Hill. It's at Extraordinary Ventures.
Yeah, a little closer to the mic.
Okay. Extraordinary Ventures in Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
So Saturday, October 11th, coming up.
And that's going to be where? Where would somebody find out about it?
There are a couple different places. I'll give you the website first, because you can go to the website and you can actually get information and sign up on the website if you want. The website is www.arenc.org, or you can call for reservations to Linda at 919-790-9130. The name of the workshop is The Spiritual Path, Signposts on Your Inner Voyage.
And in that, you're going to be discussing what we've talked about here in other shows as spiritual direction, or how you having a relationship with the big one inside,
right,
or outside, or wherever the big one happens to be. And considering that we are about to face a major meltdown of the credit system in things, and we may have to do things besides shop, people, to have a good time, spiritual direction isn't a bad way to go, because when you don't have any money, you can still pray.
Amen.
And it don't cost you anything.
Amen. Amen. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you better.
Yeah. give us a reflection on what you think's going on. Why would anybody be interested in going to a lecture about how to know God when everybody knows that the easiest way to know God is to say, "Hey God, here I am. And by the way, why did you give me my bicycle that I wanted when I was 9 years old?"
There you go. You put your finger right on it. I mean, my feeling is everybody's on the spiritual path, whether they know it or not, or whether they even believe in the big one. They're still on the spiritual path. The problem is not getting the bicycle. The problem is people are doing everything they know how to do to progress spiritually and are having problems,
mm-hmm,
and they don't know why. So a lot of times, you know, people are mad at God. There are a lot of people who are mad at God. They know it.
Yeah, well, I'm sympathetic to being mad at God.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The bicycle, you know, the doll, whatever. I mm-hmm. asked for it. God didn't give it to me. What's going on?
Therefore,
here?
God doesn't exist.
Does not, or doesn't like me, you know.
Yeah.
Which is
He's
worse.
Even worse. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
So part of the focus for me is what exactly is in the way? What's the problem here? And so that's a lot of what we'll be talking about. What are the blocks? We know that we're on the spiritual path. We're reading. We're listening to lectures. We're going to workshops. We're listening to Paul on the radio. I mean, that should be enough right there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not happening. So what are the blocks? What's in the way? What's happening? And of course, my simple answer is whatever they are, they're inside. Stop looking out there, you know, for people who are doing this to you, or even God's doing this to you. The answers are always inside.
Or the banker's doing it to us,
well,
or the Congress is doing it to us, or the president's doing it to us.
Right.
Or we're, or we've made a contract that we think we're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy to see outside influences. They're there. I'm not saying they're not there. They're there, but they're not really what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people who don't have any money, or not very much money, and they're doing just fine, thank you very much, because they've got things straight inside.
Okay, so what is this inside that they got straight that we don't necessarily, that we may not know about?
Well, what's the path about? You know, you say the path's about knowing God, and that's one way of putting it. I say the path's about knowing yourself,
mm-hmm,
and that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to know yourself, then you've gotten to know God, because they're kind of intertwined there. So my feeling is that the real problem with people on the path is not these unknown problems, but the fact that we're actually afraid of the outcome of spiritual growth.
Yeah.
We don't really want it because it scares us.
We could be in serious trouble. I mean, we're afraid that that we're going to face the meltdown of the world economic system, and that credit will evaporate, and our economy will come to a standstill, and we'll all be thrown out of our jobs and become poor. And our life savings will disappear,
such as they are.
Yeah. And so that's pretty terrifying in itself. And then I go inside and say, "Gee whiz, I don't want to know who this is in here. This is scary too. I got nowhere to turn but fear. You know, I'm fear inside, fear outside. What am I going to do?"
Well, what's the benefit of all this terrible stuff?
Yeah.
The benefit of crises is that it causes you to reexamine your life. Now, I've written a book, and it's about illness. And the premise of the book is illnesses come to you in the service of healing, because the illness causes you to look at your life and look at your values. Now, this crisis, this economic crisis, is going to have the same effect. All of a sudden, you know, if my value is the big SUV and the big TV and the big this and the big that, all of a sudden, that's going to be gone. If that's what I value, it's like my world is falling apart. But if you're smart, you'll look at your values and ask yourself what's important. If you get a serious illness, all of a sudden your job and all these other things are no longer important. And what is important is relationships with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still what's important. And when the TV is gone, the car is gone, the house is gone, you're going to find that what you've got left is your family and your loved ones. And that's what was important all along. Maybe we needed this to find that out. No, we didn't need this to find that out. But some people are going to find that out through this crisis.
Well, but there are people in which that may not be the case. In which,
sure.
You know, in which their job or their profession or whatever has been so fully consuming that they don't really have good relationships with people.
Right.
You know, they don't have... And that's a tragedy in itself. And they don't have the necessarily have the skills or the basic trust or whatever it is to even establish those things.
Well, they have them. They don't know that they have them. Everybody has those skills. And if you get down low enough, you may find them.
Yeah, maybe. Well, one of the classic ways that one often goes and finds this inside that we've heard is not from your strengths, but from your weaknesses. And, you know, suddenly where the areas where we've placed our trust, such as in our bank account or the security of our job or the security of our lives, the security of our health, if one of those gets hit hard, or more of them gets hit hard, we're going to turn to our weakness. We're going to say, "Jesus, I can't do this."
Right.
This is the classic first step in AA.
Yeah,
you know, admit that you're powerless.
Yeah,
and I'm not necessarily a big fan of AA, but the fact of the matter is that where we often find the divine lingering, holding us in a way, caring for us, is in the areas where we're still hurting and where we're still in pain. And let's deal with some of that. What some of the general types of inner fear are about self-growth?
Well, certainly. I mean, one of the fears about self-growth is I'm going to have incredible responsibility. If I come into the fullness of my being, whatever that is,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to have this incredible responsibility.
You're going to have to become Guru Bob.
That's right.
Guru Bob.
Guru Bob, yeah.
Yeah.
$29.95.
Yeah.
And you're today gonna... only. Call now.
That's right.
But
right. Immediate illumination for those who get in before before the hour's out.
That's
right. Right. You know, we could give you that magic word and your mind will be nothing but pure light and delight.
Amen. Yes. Amen, brother. So, but what's the problem? The problem with Christianity is if you look at the model in Christianity for enlightenment, what a crummy model Jesus is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he got beat up. He got crucified. It's like, hey, that sounds good to me.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. We got a whole bunch of crosses out here. We want you to come down and carry one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, Jesus wasn't really, in that sense, wasn't a good model for what it means to be enlightened. But you know, that's not what it means to be enlightened. That was his trip. That's what he chose to do.
This messianic, be the victim, be the scapegoat. Well, you know, actually, one of the arguments that I was quite taken with, though it's somewhat outre for the average Joe, is that the unique things about the Gospels was the first time the story was told about a scapegoat.
Hmm.
About somebody who was killed so that the group would feel better about itself.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is when you're faced with something you don't know what to do, you don't know how to fix, and we're going to find scapegoats with this economic process. So of course, we've got a wonderful scapegoating process called our elections, which is kind of a little fairer than some of the other kind of scapegoatings where the Congress finds somebody to pick on. But but we're going to find a scapegoat and blame them and do that. And that's going to make us feel temporarily comfortable. But it probably ain't going to fix the problem.
No.
Well, that's kind of what happened to Jesus. The Jews weren't too happy with supposedly what he was preaching. That's one version of why he got things. More likely, the Jews who were in cahoots with the Romans didn't like what he was doing because he was representing a popular authority figure outside of what they thought they could control, what they thought was the status quo means of acceptability, and that made the Romans uncomfortable. And when they were uncomfortable, what they did is just killed the buggers who were doing this stuff. You know, rabble rousers kind of things. Yeah, they just kill them right away. Not only kill them, but kill everybody else that's around them. And terrorize everybody and keep people in terror. That's the way Rome's ruled. Divide, conquer, and terrorize.
Right. It works.
And it works, you know. And by the way, the British were very good at it. And the reason Iraq is so crazy today is partly because of what the Brits did there more than 100 years ago. But that's neither here nor here. The point of it is you have scapegoats. And the unique thing about the Gospels is that this is the story told from the point of view of the scapegoat, and so that you can see the profound injustice of scapegoating.
Yeah.
Now, the only problem is that when scapegoating doesn't work, even though it's sort of a false thing, usually the next alternative is war.
Yeah, yeah. That works, too.
Yeah, but it's a little scary. The scary doesn't work, you know. So we had Saddam Hussein scapegoat, even though he was a bad guy, he was still a scapegoat. But they couldn't get rid of him, so they had a war, and things break down, you know. Now the problem here is the good thing about the Gospels is you can suddenly see that the mechanism of feeling good is scapegoats don't work because Jesus was a scapegoat, and
look what happened.
He was a good guy, you know. Not only that, he was the good guy.
That's right.
And when you think about it, we're all really good people. I mean, if you go look at mainline religion today, be it liberal or even evangelical or more conservative religion, is that one of the things that is stated, and this is across denominational and interreligious lines, is the profound importance of the human person.
Right.
That human beings are worth more. And yet we have an economic system which treats human beings as minor inconveniences.
Commodities.
Yeah, the contract is more important than the people who were hoodwinked into taking the contract. This is the latest scandal of the loans. People were basically put into veritable loans which they could not afford when interest rates went up. You know, they bought in, they could afford it. Interest rates ups, they couldn't afford it. They defaulted, so forth. Well, the contract was always a lie.
Right.
They were missold a bill of goods. And the fact of the matter is who's accountable for that? The people who sold it to them. And yet the companies that sold it, missold these things that basically created this lie, we're bailing them out instead of the people who need to stay in their homes. You know, which basically says, why not renegotiate the contract? Well, they don't want to do that. No. That would create inviolable tendencies, you know. You know, you made these lousy loans. You could refinance them at a lower rate. You won't make as much money on them. But the fact of the matter is where banking makes its money is on subprime loans. That's where it made all its money for years, and that's the reason why we're in this crisis.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting to talk about the contract, because that's another way of looking at the problem with this whole in-line thing, is that
we
think the contract says one thing,
yeah,
and it may say something different, that we don't want to sign it if it means I got to be a scapegoat.
Yeah.
And I think the problem, you know, from my point of view with Christianity as a whole, the whole Jesus thing, is the church has the tendency to look at the birth of Jesus and the death and resurrection of Jesus and, wait a minute, what was important was the teachings in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we look at the teachings and stop being so worried about with a virgin birth and a crucifixion and resurrection? Those, to me, are the least important parts of the New Testament.
Right.
The important part are the teachings. Like the Buddhists say, if you meet Buddha on the road, kill him. Why? Because the Buddha's not important. It's the teachings that are important.
Right. That was the Dharma. It's the truth that's important.
Not the guy.
Not the person who happens to be mentioning it to you at the time.
Right. But it's easier to look at the gee whiz stuff. And in a sense, that helps you to avoid actually following the teachings.
Yeah. So what are some of the teachings of in spiritual and getting to know ourselves, particularly in a way that isn't based on, reinvesting in my bank account?
Yeah.
I got to start over, friends, yeah.
Well, you know, my feeling about spirituality is that it is incredibly simple. And that the same with theology, you know,
mm-hmm.
that we tend to complexify things that are very simple. It makes us seem more important or more knowledgeable. It's really very simple. And recently, you know, you had people reading The Secret and watching the movie The Secret, The Law of Attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think it's as simple as that, that whatever we put out in our thought, we're going to get back. The problem is not that that law doesn't work. The problem is 90% of the people that try to use that law, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And there are not enough people talking about why it doesn't work. They're getting up to say, you do this, you do your affirmations, you visualize, blah, blah, blah. You'll get everything you want. And so all those people out there, they do that, and they don't get what they want. And so they say, am I doing it wrong? Am I a bad person? Is it because I'm sinful? All this junk. No, it's because you have reasons not to get what you say you want. Let me give you an example of this. I love this. Let's take something simple in the economic situation. I want $1 million. Come on, God. I'm going to visualize it. I'm going to write it down. I'm going to say affirmations all day
mm-hmm.
long. Now, why?
I know if you love me, I'm a millionaire. Yeah.
But why haven't I got that $1 million? I can
mm-hmm.
tell you exactly for myself. As soon as I start thinking, I want $1 million, my mind comes in and says, what, you know, how much of that's going to go into taxes? Am I going to have to give this away to some of my family and friends? You know, is this going to cause problems in my relationship? I can come up with 10 reasons immediately why $1 million is going to be a problem for me.
Let me have $1 million and I won't tell anybody.
That's it. But, you know, there are psychiatrists who specialize in helping people who have come into money suddenly because they cannot handle it. So that's just one example. But my point is, whatever it is you want, if you say, I want it, God says, fine, it's yours. But you have a reason not to accept it. It has nothing to do with God, has nothing to do with the law. You're following the law, but there's part of you says, no, I don't think I want that. I have reasons not to have that. Even healing yourself. No, thank you. On the surface, yes, I want to be healed. Yes, I want the money. Yes, I want this. I want that. But inside, there's something that says, no. One of the things I've discovered, Paul, that's kind of frightening to me, and I discovered in my dreams, is whatever I believe, whatever I'm putting out there, this is what I believe, this is what I live by, there's a part of myself that says, mm-mm, I don't believe it.
Actually, you remind me of one of the great conundrums that I've lived with for a number of years. When I went to seminary, which is quite a while ago now, almost 20 years, In my first year of seminary, I had a dream, and in the dream, I'm walking along with Jesus, which I guess is a good dream when you're in seminary. And Jesus is saying to me, we're sort of rushing down the road, Jesus is saying to me in a kind of rushed way, he says, you know, Paul, and I'm holding a candle, right? And it's bright, it's noontime, right, and I'm holding this candle, and it's lit, right, you know. And Jesus said, he says, you know, he says, Paul, having that candle lit in the bright in the noonday is like is wasting your wick. You know, and I thought to myself, it was okay, you know, all right, you know, and it kind of reminded me, you know, the berry, the bushel, you know, some of the parables over there. But I thought, what the heck does that mean? You know, so I went around and I asked people what it meant, you know. And, you know, and to be honest with you, I've always been puzzled by it. You know, I mean, I was always puzzled. What did this mean? And, you know, and I was reflecting on my experience of seminary about a month ago. And suddenly, and I remembered that dream and that vision or whatever it was. And I thought, now I know what it meant. It's very similar to what you just said. Basically, what it was telling me, and it was definitely my experience of seminary, was nobody was going to notice my spiritual whatever it was.
Your little candle?
Yeah, I was going to notice my candle in the environment that I was in. And that was my experience of seminary. I mean, I was, before I went to seminary, extremely well-read and learned in many religions, including Christianity. Right, I mean, this was not new. I didn't get this learning overnight. I've been doing it all my life in terms of reading and studying and thinking. But while I was there, everybody thought I had no religion at all and I was faithless. And I thought, this is the strangest thing. I said, I know I got faith, but I said, nobody seems to know it here. You know, I said, no matter, you know.
You're the Roger Dangerfield.
I don't know what it, yeah.
Can't get no respect.
No respect, yeah. So I eventually, you know, phased out of seminary and phased ultimately out of the ministry because nobody noticed in my denomination that I had anything to offer them either. So, and I thought to myself, you know, and so I thought back, you know, well, that was it. You know, there was this this incongruity. You know, in some ways I could say that it just wasn't my path. I mean, I thought it was something to give it the old try. But, you know, needless to say, if you want to light a candle, do it in the dark. not in the noonday sun.
but that idea, I mean, it's kind of shocking to think that there is some part of ourselves that is in opposition to us. I mean, if you have somebody out there or some organization that's in opposition to you, that's a message. That's saying, hey, you've got some inner opposition you better look at. And as I said, you know, I found an aspect of myself totally opposed to my philosophy of life, angrily opposed to my philosophy. Well, how am I going to get ahead when I got some guy inside saying no? Every time I say yes, he's saying no.
Yeah, well, for me, I always call that my baby Paul. That's baby Paul. He's in opposition there.
Yeah.
And he's a mean guy because he doesn't
cranky.
Ever say anything.
He's
he just cranky. Says, yeah, I'm not going to say anything.
But we need to know that, don't we? Yeah. We need to know
can't
that
convince
that guy's
him
in there.
Anything. Yeah, he's got this, you know, inconvertible silence of obstinacy.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and you know,
so how do we? So I take baby Paul and his bassinet and hold him up to God and say, "Here, God, I can't take care of the babe no more."
No. What you have to do, you know, the difficulty of this stuff is that you have to say, "This baby's working for me. This baby's working. This is my baby.
Yeah.
And this baby's working for me. Yeah. So I need to find out what he is doing. How is he serving me? And he may be exactly the guy that's protecting you from that spiritual thing that you may not be so sure about. And that's what mine. Mine is protecting me.
From a million bucks you want.
From the million bucks or from enlightenment, you know, Christ consciousness. Why am I not Christ conscious? Because some part of me is saying no.
Well,
why are they saying no? Because I'm afraid of it.
Well, but I've always assumed that I was enlightened. It was just that I hadn't put all the pieces together.
No, we are. I agree. My feeling about enlightenment, I think it's an important point. We were created enlightened. We've been enlightened from the beginning. We're always going to be enlightened. It's a question of, can we accept it?
Yeah.
Can we experience it? It's not in a oneness with God. Well, we are one with God. We cannot be other than one with God.
Yeah.
No, so do I recognize it? Do I experience it? Do I express it? No.
Well, again by degrees, you know.
Exactly.
I'm a small fountain, you know, attempting, as it were. I'm a little garden hose attempting to, you know, drain the Atlantic.
That's okay. Well, here's the other thing, Paul. Yeah. We got lots of time, don't we? We got lots of time.
We do.
Yeah, well, eternity.
Life. There's this little blip of life is so tiny.
It's a breath in, a breath out. It's over with. So
yeah, exactly.
So let's relax about it.
You really think so? I mean, just the old hose will eventually get all the get everything out.
Yeah.
Get those fish out of that hose, people.
Yeah, you know, we got to take it easy on ourselves. We got lots of time. Lots of time. So just, you know, back off, take it easy. Don't be, you know, this is a problem for me personally, self-judgment. That's a big one. I judge other people too, of course.
Yeah.
But self-judgment.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, you know, actually, I think we mentioned that before. One of the things I always came across is that judgment is actually thinking. In other words, when you think about anything, you judge it. And of course, we think about things all along, but what we don't recognize is by doing that, by sort of doing this little definitional type thing in our head all the time, we are blocking the flow of what's really going on.
Right.
And it's kind of, you know, so the question of how to be with ourselves in a way that isn't judging all the time. I mean, I love to think, you know. In fact, I said the only reason I don't meditate that much is because I'd rather think, you know. I said, is that sort of like saying I'd rather vomit than eat? You know?
Well,
I don't know.
I hope not. No.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm. But the point is that thinking is this definite thing. Well, okay, so how can you be with yourself and not think?
I don't know. I am not able to do it.
Really?
No, it's a big challenge for me.
Well, I think that there's...
I can do it in little pieces.
Yeah. Well, yeah, little pieces. Actually, you know, it's sort of like breathing. It's not all one direction.
Right.
You know, it's not at all, you know, what it is I was born and then I exhaled and then I died and then I expired, you know.
Yeah.
That was it, you know. There's usually an inhale in there along the way. And so somewhere along there's an inhale and an exhale. And the same way we're thinking. There's a judging and there's a non-judging.
So we do
lighten up. But I think what it lighten up on our between judgments,
yeah.
You know, maybe that's the gavel hitting the ground. You know?
And there are lots of techniques to stop thinking. You know,
yeah.
I try them all, and I'm sometimes successful and sometimes not.
So give one, for instance.
Well, let's go back to Ram Dass and Be Here Now.
Okay.
He suggested that you simply listen.
Mm-hmm.
If you have one of your senses engaged, you really can't think at the same time. If you're really listening, you cannot think at the same time. It's like if you're watching TV and you're watching the news and there's that stuff rolling across the screen.
If you're trying to read that,
you can't read it.
You can't
can either listen or you can read. You can't do both.
That's right. I've noticed that. It's really hard to
do
both.
So you listen, and of course, you can always say affirmations or mantras to bring yourself back to the silence. There are a lot of techniques, and they work for a while.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, that they're not permanent is not terrible. Apparently, even the Dalai Lama, who's been practicing this stuff for a lot longer and with a lot more diligence in it and guidance than most of us ever will have, even he says he still thinks.
Well, he also says he's not enlightened.
Yeah.
Well, there's hope for all of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I recognize is that those folks who go through that, you know, your Buddhist monks and other 20 years, 30 years meditating, they do not all become enlightened.
Yeah.
There are lots of benefits of what they do, and they may become very peaceful and compassionate, all that, which is excellent, but not necessarily enlightened.
Right. And, you know, so it's sort of like, you know, okay, I put my, 10 cents down on this game, and this is the one I'm going to play.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win, you know. But the other thing about enlightenment is it really isn't a win-lose game.
No.
It's really a win game. Everybody wins. Some people win more obviously than others. The, you know, one of the great fallacies about enlightenment is thinking that anybody's going to notice.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, the other thing, you talked about the hose in the ocean. The other thing is that there's enlightened behavior that occurs every day. You know, if you smile at somebody, that's enlightened behavior. If you give somebody a hug, that's enlightened behavior. If you listen to a friend who's in trouble, that's enlightened behavior. So it's also something we do every day, and that we can just pay more attention to doing that more. And if, and one day you'll find out, gosh, I'm doing enlightened stuff all day long now.
Yeah. And it reminded me, John Blofeld, who was a well-known commentator on traditional China, had spent a lot of time in China, wrote some good books on China stuff. He wrote a book. It was his last book he wrote. And he basically said, this is for my children, you know, who weren't at that time particularly interested in his theories of enlightenment. He said one of the things he said is, he says, if you have a sense of what you think enlightenment is, then act as if you were enlightened. He says, just keep acting as if you're enlightened. He says, your image of enlightenment will be refined over time. And as it refines, continue to refine your behavior to act as if you're enlightened.
Right. What would Jesus do? What would the Buddha do?
You know?
Yeah.
And I thought, gee whiz, this is not a bad idea, but I said, it sounds awfully phony. You know?
Well,
but
no,
in some ways, it isn't phony.
No. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's kind of an excellent technique. I had a person in an audience one time when I was talking about this, projecting ahead what you want to be.
Yeah.
And she said, in high school, we say, fake it until you make it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's legitimate, because there is a part of me in the future who has already made it. So I'm really just trying to contact that and act that way now. I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that your initial understanding of what this enlightenment stage might be might seem fallacious later, as you grow in maturity and understanding of what happens. But hey, at least I tried. You know.
Yeah.
At least I attempted to return kindness for anger. You know?
See, you there are certain things that you can do that you cannot possibly go wrong on. You mentioned kindness. Dalai Lama says, that's my religion. If you're simply kind every day, you're on your way. What else do you need to do?
Yeah, well, most people don't notice how kind I am. So. I guess it's because I only do it with a grump. I'm a grump.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah, it's true.
But I have to tell you, I mean, we have within us incredible abilities. And I had an experience, I'll just tell you briefly about it, because it has to do with this fake it till you make it, in a sense.
Yeah.
And that is, I'm walking down the street minding my own business. I'm very interested in dreams. I've read a lot about dreams. I write my own dreams down, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Never occurred to me to ever work with anybody else with dreams. And
yeah.
So I have a voice in my head. And I'm telling you, Paul, in public here, I never had a voice in my head before that time. I haven't had a voice in my head since, so don't lock me up. But the voice said, you are an expert on dreams. Now, here's the important thing about that. That was not true at that moment, but within 6 months to a year, it became true.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave my first dream class, having never taken a dream class, having never studied under anybody. I put on my first dream class, and before that class was over, I told you last time I was on the radio talking about dreams,
right?
As if I were an expert. So my point is, that voice knew something about me that I did not know, something that was actually true in the future, but it gave me the courage to make that true. Without that, I may never have done that.
Well, that's true. I mean, experiences like that happen. In my case, for instance, what I had as I was, I found this mystic, Mujahideen Ibn Arabi, who was actually one of the great Sufi mystics in Islam, lived about 1200. And I found that what little I found about him at the time, which is back in the 70s, there wasn't a lot available about him at the time. There's a lot more translated now. And but I found what he was saying, and his philosophy was very simpatico. It seemed very logical. It had psychological sophistication, and I liked what he was saying, so I was attracted to it. And so I was studying some of the things that were available, and at one point I got very frustrated, and I said, God, I really don't understand this, and I think I should. It's important. And I thought, well, you know, God, you know, that's the purpose of studying this stuff is to know God better, to know myself better. But, you know, what I'm going to do, and God, I'm sure, is, you know, capable of helping, but I'm going to say, you know, Ibn Arabi, you wrote it. You know, you these are your ideas. Help me. And immediately, you know, I had that, you know, this guy pops up and says, okay, you know, I will show you that you'll understand this stuff. You know, and I'll be your guide, you know. And I was, you know, astounded. It wasn't an imaginative thing, but it was autonomous and almost in the way that you described that you're a dream expert.
Yes.
And, I went and continued to study, and should have written all the stuff down, but I had a lot of insights into Ibn Arabi. Still am. I'm still actually considered by some people, except for those people who read Arabic, are pretty knowledgeable about Ibn Arabi and his writings and purport in terms of his basis of Sufism. Most Sufism, in terms of its training, Luke, and also most of the mystical exegesis of the Quran is highly influenced by Ibn Arabi. At the sort of left wing of Ibn Arabi is that the only existence is God, which is somewhat too much, which is too much for most Orthodox people to take. So there's also a reaction against Ibn Arabi, of which some of the groups that support the terrorists today would be. The first person they would burn or bomb would be Ibn Arabi and Sufis. Actually, there's a book out about this subject now. It's called The Other Islam. It was written by a friend of mine. Doesn't have too much to say about Ibn Arabi, but he does definitely talk about how Sufism in the Muslim world does really represent a attempt to prevent and to stop the kind of craziness that has led to suicide bombings in Palestine, right, and the terrorism of the Taliban and Al Qaeda, which all have different causes, but all of them react on a kind of austere orthodoxy in which God is, you know, the supreme ruler of the universe, and we're nothing but the slaves under his feet. And if you don't have that clearly in your head, you're not going to get into paradise.
Right. Well, my feeling is when you look at, you know, fundamentalism, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Judaism,
right,
is a very closed system. And what I've learned is you can be a fundamentalist in any system. You can be in spirituality, you can be a follower of this system or that, and you can really gain from it and get a lot from it. Or you become a fundamentalist and you just think this is it. Anything else is not true, and then, you know, you turn yourself off, you close yourself off, and you're really not being of help to anybody else, especially yourself. So I think fundamentalism is a dangerous thing.
Well, yeah, yes and no. There are aspects of let's talk about evangelical Christians. There are aspects in which if you really try to follow the strictures of their behavior norms, and you're within the community.
Right.
You get a sense of order. Your friends come predefined for you. You know,
right.
You have friends. You have things you can do. You have have a way of praying and expectations with prayer. There is a structure to that, and that works to a degree, and is relatively comfortable for people. Of course, the demonization of it is the shadow you cast, because there are people that can't be accepted within that norm. For instance, homosexuals who wish to actually live as homosexuals. You know, you can be a homosexual as an evangelical, but you can't practice. You know, you have to be celibate, you know. Or you have to even be better, just deny that you're homosexual and try to live as a heterosexual, which might be rather unpleasant, you know.
Well, the problem with the fundamentalism is not their own community and how they behave in their community.
Yeah.
The problem is the judgment of others to the extreme of thinking the others should be locked up or killed.
Yeah, and that's you can't evangelicals who are you know, really working in the good news aspects recognizes that this demonization of the other really isn't their concern. They shouldn't be demonizing the other. It's right. not always true. I mean, right. there's definitely plenty that do the hellfire and brimstone, and they're demonizing you. And if you get abused in a religion like that, I can understand why you wouldn't want to have anything to do with religion. Part of the issue of dealing with spiritual self-work is that some of us have been beaten up by our religion, that we got more hellfire and brimstone than we got, you know,
right.
Jesus' love of light and bright guide to my true self, you know.
Right. And you got to be careful about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because it's not the religion's fault; it's the denomination or the group or whatever.
And the minister, just the accident of the religious culture we're in. There are toxic, evil practices in religion that are Christian, that are Buddhist, that are Jewish,
yes.
that are all of them. There are toxic aspects to them, which, and at the same time, most of the religions should have within themselves ways of cleaning out that toxicity, you know. That's why I raised the issue with the book on the other Islam, is that it definitely showing that there is resources within Islam itself to clean out the toxicity of this religion. Part of the reason that it's not getting that it's slow and awakening or working is that there's incredible amounts of resources are being, you know, put into the toxic forms of the religion, such as the petrodollars that support Wahhabism which is a form of this toxic religion.
But you have to be aware. I mean, if you're part of the toxin, you have to be aware. Why should you change? Why are you going to change if you don't know that you're toxic? There was a story about a Baptist minister who had a near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
And in his near-death experience, he saw himself as this 9-year-old boy who was in the church listening to him. And he was doing his hellfire and brimstone, and he was literally scaring the hell out of this kid. And when he saw that in this after-death experience, he thought, "Oh my God, you know, I don't want to do that." So he realized his own toxic effect on this kid, and he changed his whole focus because of that. So you have to first become aware that what you're believing or what you're speaking or what you're doing is toxic. That's why awareness is sort of the path.
So let's again give your give the contact information for your spiritual direction course. Again, right. This is on October 11th.
Yes, and the name of it is The Spiritual Path: Signposts on Your Inner Voyage, and it is at Extraordinary Ventures, which is on Elliott Road in Chapel Hills, across from the barbecue place. Anyway, contact information. Go on the website if you can, and you can sign up there. You can get information there. That's www.arenc.org. You can make reservations by phone at Linda Thompson is the name of our registrar, 919-790-9130. Now, the price is $45 up until the 5th. After the 5th, it's $55, which is cheap. And one last thing.
Okay, convince me that this is cheap.
$45, are you kidding? The ARA is always cheap.
Right, inexpensive.
Yeah. It's inexpensive, too.
Yes. Right.
So the other thing is, if you were interested in a private session with me, those will be available the 2 days following the workshop, Sunday and Monday. You can call Wayne Miller for a private session, 919-783-6045, and I'll fix everything.
Okay. Well, we'll challenge him on that. Give that Wayne Miller name a number again.
Wayne Miller, this is for private sessions, 919-783-6045.
Okay, so here I've come into you tremulously. Let's say I didn't take your – I didn't get to the
you
class.
You don't have to take the conference
So let's say I didn't get to class, and I come into you, and I – of course, we don't know each other, right?
No.
And I've got my little 50 – whatever it is – whatever your private sessions
are.
Your
ticket, yeah.
I've got my ticket here, and I tremendously give it to you. What should I expect? Assuage my fear and trepidations as I settle down. Is my life not going to come to an end because I've decided that I want to know myself better?
No, the sessions are really simple. It's a scam, really, because what happens is you come in and you have to tell me what the issue is. You tell me what you want to work on, what you want to have changed.
Well, I'm perfectly happy myself.
Why are you coming to me if you're happy?
I'm not
interested. You're wasting my time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's sit here and be happier together.
No, I mean, a person...
You always be happier, can't you?
A person, no, but it's not about happiness. You could come in and say, I'm just feeling a little blocked in my spiritual growth. My life is good,
yeah.
But I'd like to progress. So you don't have to come in with a problem if you don't want to, okay?
No, okay.
All right. So you tell me what the issue is, what you want to work on.
All right.
And I say, okay, Paul. Then,
I'm spiritually constipated.
You're spiritually constipated. I say, Paul, well, what do you need to do to solve that? And you say,
I need to take a laxative.
And then I'll say, okay, Paul, now what you need to do is go home and take a laxative.
Right.
So you tell me what the issue is. You tell me how to solve it, and then I tell you, okay, go solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pay me.
Yeah. So if you're interested in... And getting a drink of water by the well, Bob will hold the cup for you.
Yes. Well, here's three specifics. I can work with visualizations. I can work with dreams. I can work with past lives.
So if you have an issue around dreams, perhaps you have a recurring dream, where you're being chased by the boogeyman. And all of a sudden you're about to be eaten and you wake up in a cold sweat. Common dream, I know. Many of us have this dream, but Bob will act as the boogeyman for you.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you could try to find out who that boogeyman is chasing us down the road. Okay, what's this past life stuff? Now, some people might find this intriguing.
Well, I mean, everybody knows about past lives. That's been around for thousands of years, the idea of past lives. And my take,
unless you're a bona fide Orthodox thinking Christian and Jew, then you may be a little less willing to admit that.
Well, it depends on what kind of Jew you are, because one of the Jewish sect did believe in past lives, and if you're a good Christian, you should go to the Bible, and it will tell you in the New Testament about incidences of past lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the real deal.
Oh, well, so where in the Bible does it talk about past lives?
Well, for example, when the disciples went to John, and John wanted to know who this Jesus guy was, or Jesus wanted to know who John was. They were asking John, who are you? Are you Elijah? Are you this guy? So that meant that they saw him as perhaps the reincarnation of some prophet.
Oh, you think of that? It wasn't just saying Elijah as, oh, you're a prophet like Elijah.
They didn't say like Elijah. Yeah. Don't mess with the Bible.
Sorry.
Jeez.
Just a interpretations here. Okay, so that for you is an example of the possibility of past lives.
Right, right. Plus the fact that dreams, people have dreams about past lives. I've had past life dreams, and people are some attracted to certain cultures.
Mm-hmm.
They're attracted to certain times. They don't really know why. In some cases, people will go to Europe or somewhere, and they'll actually recognize a place they've never seen before. They'll have an emotional reaction to that place. My feeling about past lives is that they're just grist for the mill. It's just more information. A past life is just like a dream. It's just like a visualization. It's information. It's just like looking at your childhood. All of that stuff is just information you can use to make changes in your life. Past lives, that's just one way to go. You don't have to work with past lives. You don't have to work with dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever works for you to open up your own blocks, your own fears, and deal with them.
Right. So I guess, as I said, one of the things that we're facing now is that because of this exterior fears that we have, one of the opportunities of this is this will actually may give us an opportunity to discover other ways to be happy and joyous that don't require shopping or, you know, living on the laurels of our fat bank account and clipping coupons. If that's the case, even though things may be difficult, we will probably discover ways of loving and being generous with one another that are far more genuine than they represent you know, property or class or privilege.
Right, right. We're going to find out what's really important.
Yeah, and that's good. You know, I had a story that happened to me when I was a kid, and it's one of these little strange stories that stands out of nowhere. I'm basically coming back from a friend of mine's house. It wasn't ever really a good friend, but he was. But I was hanging out with him for that day, and I was going home. And this kid is walking along the street, and he stops me, and he says, he's a little older than me, maybe, you know, like he's maybe like in junior high school, and I'm like, you know, a grade school kid. That's a big difference, you know, in the kid hierarchy. And he says, "Hey, kid," he says, "come here." And he's got these bags with him, and he says, "come here." He says, "I want to give you," he says, "you want some candy?" "Oh, but they get candy from strangers, right?" Yeah, it's a classic. Every kids know that, right? "Yeah, I don't want to give those." He says, look. He says, "today was my birthday. And my grandfather gave me a bunch of money and told me to go out and buy anything I wanted. You know, so I just been down there and I bought all this candy. And I bought all this stuff and I bought all these toys and stuff." He says, "you know what? I'm really not happy." He says, "yeah, none of this stuff made me happy." He says, "I would have been much happier if I'd actually spent some time with my granddad, you know, and talked to him, instead of having this money to buy this stuff." He says, "this will make me happy." He says, "you'd be doing me a favor if you take some of the candy, or even some of the toys." He just looked at the toys, I saw the slinky toy, and I was like, you know. But I thought, gee whiz, I go home and I've got candy and I've got a toy. My mother will kill me and she won't believe it. She'll think I went and stole it. You know, she ain't going to believe no kid on the sidewalk gave it to me, you know.
That's right.
You know, so I had to turn down the toys. But I did take a candy bar to eventually talk me into it. And so I was, you know, walking home, thinking about this stuff. Like, gee, that's a strange encounter. And then as I got turned around the corner and looked at the house, there sitting in front of the house was a brand new station wagon, 1956. So I knew this took place in 1957. We were getting rid of that. They got one of them old new cars, you know. And, you know, and of course I was pissed off that they didn't take me to pick the car out, but they... But besides that, they had a new car, and it happened to correspond. So I remember the date very well. So I know I was about 9 years old when this happened. And it's an interesting story. I mean, it's like a dream in a way, but it's so profound because what that kid was telling me was something which is eternally true.
Yeah,
you know, that for him, he recognized that money could never be the relationship, the time that he could have spent with his grandfather.
Yeah, yeah.
And that meant more than that money or any of this stuff. Stuff couldn't do it. Right. Stuff can't do it.
We're all going to find that out.
Yeah, and you know, and it's some, you know, it happens in degrees. Some of us find it out sooner than others. You know?
That's a very wise young man.
Yeah, I don't know how I was wise enough to remember it. I don't know if I'm wise enough to live it.
Well, he was a wise man, not you.
You
were the recipient.
I was eating the candy, but that's true. But I remember that last part of that candy bar. I remember spitting it out, you know, because I wanted to rush off to look at the new car. Yeah, and since I didn't pay for it, it didn't matter, right? You know. But so ultimately, the ants ended up getting it.
Somebody always wins.
Yeah, somebody always wins. That's the thing. Yeah, so while we've been listening to WCOM, LP, Chapel Hill and Carbarrel, this is 103.5 in your FM dial. It's your community radio station, and I'm your host for Touchstones, and we've been talking to Bob Trowbridge about spiritual direction, and he's going to be available at in 2 weeks for a class on spiritual direction. And again, give him all that good old information in case you haven't written it down already. Give it to him again, Bob.
All right, one more time. Spiritual Path, Signposts on Your Inner Voyage, Saturday, October 11th at Extraordinary Ventures in Chapel Hill. And the website is www.arenc.org. The registrar is Linda Thompson. You can call her at 919-790-9130. And if you're interested in private sessions on that Sunday and Monday following the workshop, you can call Wayne Miller at 919-783-6045. Be there or be square.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying, Bob, is that you got your shingle out as a spiritual director. Would you consider seeing people in on a long-term basis? Like, you know, the classic version of spiritual direction, the one that I was schooled in, is you see somebody intensively, like a weekly basis, for some period of time until you both feel you know each other and you're sort of set in what's happening.
Right.
And then you see each other, periodically.
Right.
Until whenever, the relationship reaches its conclusion through, change of venue or whatever goes on.
Right. Now, I'm still relatively new to the area. I do not have an office. I do phone counseling. Mm-hmm. So that's a possibility. And perhaps I should just give my phone number and
sure.
People can contact me and we can talk about that. So my number is 919-928-9876.
Right. And spiritual direction is a way to get to know yourself and your Lord or whoever that might be.
Whoever, yes.
Whatever that might be, that's bigger than ourselves, that is ourselves, but the selves that we're probably not too comfortable with calling ourselves.
Yes.
Whatever self that happens to be.
We're all better than we think we are.
That's right, right. And no, my ego is not me, even though it goes on trying to pretend that it is me all the time. That's why it talks all the time, because otherwise it wouldn't exist. So I'm sorry. This has been Touchstones, and I hope you've enjoyed our encounter again with Bob Trowbridge. We'll get him back here again and see how his practice is going.